escape. And yet it's also something that is so common, these stories are only going to continue to happen unless we do something. And so to the point of your question about how do we break this logjam, I mean, we just saw this summer, for the first time in nearly 30 years, federal legislation passed to reduce gun violence. And that's really important. I mean, up until pretty much when it happened, a lot of the conversation was, oh, this is horrible. What are we going to do? And the consensus was the change at the federal level was something that should happen, but probably wasn't going to. And then we saw within a couple of weeks that change. And the reason that it changed was that there was public pressure, there were people being outspoken, and there was a push to hold politicians accountable, because we know this issue of gun violence is preventable. We see other countries, all of our other peer nations, do not have this problem. It is only the U.S. in which we have very easy access to firearms and an oversaturation of them in our communities, where we really see this issue persist.
Robert Gentrop, we have 5 seconds. Do you think the answer is an assault weapons ban?
We do. And at Brady United, we support an assault weapons ban, universal background checks, and a slate of comprehensive solutions, all part of our Brady blueprint to prevent gun violence, that you can read at bradyunited.org.
We thank you so much for being with us, Robert Gentrop of Brady Youth Initiative, Team Enough, and Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, starting Friday, February 3rd, until Saturday, March 4th. Screenings will take place every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, bringing live interviews with filmmakers, community conversations, and more. Films will be screened at PCC Cascade, Hollywood Theater, and virtually. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org. That's the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, happening throughout the month of February in celebration of Black History Month. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org.
This is KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland Street Response is barred from giving out tents to Portlanders in need by Commissioner Renee Gonzalez.
Portland police and city negotiators reach a bargaining impasse on body cameras.
And in national news, residents of East Palestine, Ohio, are taking safety testing into their own hands in the wake of a train derailment and environmental cleanup.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 15th, 2023. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Reed Johnson. Portland Street Response will no longer be allowed to hand out tents and tarps to Portlanders who need them. Portland City Commissioner Renee Gonzalez announced a temporary suspension of tents and tarps being handed out by employees of the public safety bureaus, including Portland Street Response, last night. Gonzalez says it's because fires set inside tents or under tarps pose a danger to firefighters, homeless people, and nearby residents. But Portland Fire and Rescue's own data shows that only about 8% of quote-unquote homeless-related fires in the past 3 years were from heating sources being too close to combustibles. Homeless-related fires are also not well-defined by the fire department, and it very well may include arson against unhoused Portlanders. Last year, Portland Street Response gave out 463 tents and 193 tarps. Robin Burek, Portland Street Response Program Manager, said tent fires are a safety concern, but so is the possibility of people succumbing to hypothermia and frostbite. This order comes during a week of 4 straight nights with a forecast of freezing or below. The agency will stop handing out tents, but continue distributing winter coats and blankets. Lauren Armini, a manager at Sisters of the Road, said taking away tents will not address the reason why people start fires, which is to stay warm or to cook food.
The Portland Police Union and the city are at an impasse in their contract negotiations over body camera usage. Portland is the largest city in the U.S. whose cops don't wear body cameras, despite efforts to get them in place since 2014. The Portland Police Association and the city have been bargaining for months over contract language for body cameras, and yesterday both sides announced they were at an impasse. That means the process will be taken over by a third-party arbitrator. Both sides will have a week to submit any tentative agreements about different aspects of the policy, along with their final offer proposals for the parts that are still on the table. Officials say those documents will be released Friday. It's not yet clear where the police union in the city can't agree. But in the past, one issue was whether police officers could watch their body camera footage before writing up a report. The union wants them to be able to, but the city and the U.S. Department do not. Portland has been under a settlement agreement with the U.S. Justice Department for police using excessive force since 2014. In 2021, that settlement was extended and added changes to address the ongoing issue, including body-worn cameras by officers.
In the U.S., an estimated 1 in 20 gun killings are committed by police. Law enforcement officers murdered at least 1,192 people in 2022, the highest number recorded in a decade. That's according to the nonprofit database Mapping Police Violence. The number of people in the U.S. who die in mass shootings each year is smaller than the number killed by police. The rates of both police killings and overall homicides in the U.S. are much higher than other wealthy countries. The numbers are more on par with nations like Brazil, Colombia, Cameroon, and Sudan. Public databases from news outlets and nonprofits often show more complete and reliable data on police killings than the U.S. government. Unclear tracking means that even the staggering figure that 1 in 20 gun deaths are caused by police could be an undercount. Why this issue persists has a lot of factors, but some is a result of coding failures by coroners, medical examiners, and other public health officials, many of whom work for or are embedded within police departments.
Nikki Haley will run for president in 2024. California Senator Dianne Feinstein announces she will not seek re-election. And former VP Mike Fence would prefer to forgive and forget about January 6th. With more on these stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Donald Trump is everything I taught my children not to do in kindergarten.
Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley was once highly critical of former President Donald Trump before fully embracing his policies and persona. Now Haley stands as the first major challenger to Trump for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination. Haley said Republicans have lost the popular vote in 7 out of the last 8 presidential elections and added, quote, that has to change. California's longest-serving senator, Dianne Feinstein, says she will retire from the Senate at the end of 2024. The trailblazing Feinstein authored the 1994 assault weapons ban, an issue she still champions today.
The time has come, America, to step up and ban these weapons.
She also worked to declassify an extensive report detailing the CIA's use of torture. At age 89, Feinstein has faced growing criticism over whether she can handle the demands of the job.
I still pray for the president, and I pray for the grace to forgive him and all those responsible for that tragic day.
Former Vice President Mike Pence may have forgiven former President Donald Trump for his role in the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, but the Justice Department won't let him forget. The special counsel in charge of investigating the insurrection has issued a subpoena for Pence's testimony regarding Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Pence is reportedly planning to resist the subpoena, arguing he is protected by the Constitution's speech or debate clause, which shields members of Congress from law enforcement scrutiny. In his role as vice president, Pence was also president of the Senate. 3 students were shot and killed Tuesday at Michigan State University. Representative Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan says she is still filled with rage, recalling the recent shooting deaths of 4 high school students in her district.
And we have children in Michigan who are living through their second school shooting in under a year and a half. If this is not a wake-up call to do something, I don't know what is.
Tuesday's shooting took place on the 5-year anniversary of the shooting massacre at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, which left 17 people dead. President Biden's long-stalled nominee to the Federal Communications Commission, Gigi Sohn, says she believes at least one member of the FCC should be a consumer advocate.
I believe deeply that regulated entities should not choose their regulator.
But Sohn says industry opponents to her nomination are using dark money groups to prevent pro-consumer policies, including lower-priced broadband. Some Republicans have claimed Sohn would use her post at the FCC to censor conservatives. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
It's been 2 weeks since a Norfolk Southern train derailed in East Palestine, Ohio. The train crash released vinyl chloride, butyl acrylate, and other toxic chemicals into the air, soil, and water there. East Palestine residents were told by officials that it's safe to return home, but they're not so sure. Residents say they're not getting thorough safety information from state officials or the EPA on how contaminated their drinking water and air may be, so they're taking matters into their own hands. Nadi Ramlagan reports.
East Palestine, Ohio residents have been given the green light to return home, but many believe it isn't safe to do so. They're experiencing skin rashes, nausea, burning eyes, and other symptoms after a Norfolk Southern train derailed there 2 weeks ago, spewing toxic chemicals. A controlled burn of the highly combustible chemical cocktail released more toxic fumes into the air for miles. Hotel reimbursements after a temporary evacuation have stopped. But Jamie Kosa says she isn't taking her 3-year-old daughter Kyla back home because she doesn't feel it's safe to breathe the air or drink the water.
It was a chemical smell, almost like a paint thinner, and it had even gotten into my clothes that were in the dryer. Your nose would burn, your mouth, your eyes. You could just feel it in the air when you're breathing in, like in your chest. And that's the smell that's still in the creek.
In a news release last week, Ohio Governor Mike DeWine and state officials maintained that evacuated residents can now safely return to their homes in and around East Palestine, and those who aren't comfortable doing so can request assistance with hotel expenses from the railroad. The EPA says it screened nearly 300 homes and reports no detection of vinyl chloride or hydrogen chloride. However, Amanda Kiger with River Valley Organizing isn't convinced the agency has done a thorough job. She's angry state leaders haven't contacted FEMA to get people better compensation and housing assistance.
Many folks have been forced back home and they don't believe it's safe. They want answers. They want good, concise, clear answers.
Kiger says residents can meet with scientists and sign up for independent soil and water testing for their homes and property at a community meeting coming up. It's at 6 p.m. Eastern Time next Thursday, February 23rd. Kiger advises checking the River Valley Organizing Facebook page for updates on the location.
We're partnering with some groups in Pennsylvania to actually have a real town hall that is bringing in the scientists to speak with folks, and also some representatives from Fair Shake Legal Services, not to take on clients, but actually to disseminate this information back to people.
Kosa says for now, she's staying in West Virginia, but is stressed about what the future holds.
We honestly don't know. We don't know. We're just kind of taking it day by day. And my biggest fear is taking my baby back there.
This is Nadia Ramlagan for Ohio News Connection.
Black women have higher rates of many illnesses, from hypertension to breast cancer and diabetes. Just in time for Black History Month, a new book addresses some of the reasons and suggests ways to improve those outcomes. Roz Brown speaks with the author, Dr. Melody McLeod.
Black and African American communities are at greater risk for multiple health conditions, a health care disparity highlighted during February's Black History Month. Dr. Melody McLeod says high rates of obesity, heart disease, and maternal and infant mortality are just some of the ethnic health disparities Black women face. McLeod applauds those women who give 100% to their churches every week, but wishes they'd do the same when it comes to their health.
We may not take one day a year to go to the doctor and get our checkups done, so I try to encourage people to apply the same discipline they have for their spiritual health to their physical health.
McLeod is the author of the book, Black Women's Wellness, Your I've Got This Guide to Health, Sex, and Phenomenal Living. She says if anything good came out of COVID, it was a recognition of risk factors and how they affect health and longevity. For example, it's estimated that nearly 50,000 Black women lose their lives every year due to cardiovascular disease. The National Center for Health Statistics says the 2020 maternal mortality rate for Black women was about 55 deaths per 100,000 live births, compared to 19 for white women. McLeod says that statistic alone should encourage Black women to seek out critical health care. But she cites historical trauma, including the infamous Tuskegee experiment, as a common reason they don't.
In post-slavery days, a lot of Black women's bodies were used to experiment to teach people how to do hysterectomies and things like that. So there's this distrust that has permeated and continued throughout the psyche of the Black community.
McLeod believes unconscious bias in the medical system also needs to change.
We need more Black medical professionals because research has shown that Blacks and other minorities do receive better care and they take it in and abide by it best when it's given to them by someone of their own ethnicity.
Black History Month celebrates the generations of Black and African Americans who struggled with adversity and celebrates their many contributions. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Street Roots reporter Piper McDaniel about a new article, State of Evictions 2023. Then, an interview with an organizer of the New Seasons Workers Union. At 6, it's Earth Riot Radio. At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 29 degrees. Tomorrow, these clouds continue with a daytime high of 47. Today in history, in 1972, sound recordings are granted U.S. federal copyright protections for the first time. That includes spoken word, singing, instrumental music, and sound effects. The quote of the day is from American singer and jazz pianist Nat King Cole, who died this day in 1965. He said, quote, "I may help to bring harmony between people through my music."
In Toronto, Indigenous groups hold an annual strawberry ceremony, honoring missing and murdered Indigenous people with a march and rally. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Indigenous people and their allies held events Tuesday in Canada to honor the memory of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Dan Karpinchuk reports on the annual strawberry ceremony.
A couple of hundred people gathered in downtown Toronto Tuesday in front of police headquarters. Many of them told stories about families that have lost loved ones. During the ceremony, people were given a cup of water and a strawberry to hold. When cut in half, the strawberries look like a heart. Organizers say the strawberries are part of the memorial because it's a woman's fruit and a symbol of hope and rebirth. Organizers say the gathering in Toronto has been taking place for the past 18 years, adding that it's an opportunity to gather as a community to pray for loved ones lost to violence. Joey Twin is an Indigenous activist.
My mom was murdered when I was 6 years old in Calgary, Alberta, 59 years ago, and no justice was served for her murder. And so it's been going on for many years, our Indigenous folks, you know, getting murdered, missing and murdered. And our nations aren't greedy, our Indigenous nations. We're just asking for the equality, for the justice for us. Because in this day and age, there's two laws, one for the white man and one for us Indians.
The ceremony has been taking place outside police headquarters because of what organizers call state complicity in the murders of Indigenous women, because of police inaction, and even as perpetrators of the violence. The ceremony comes as violence against Indigenous women continues. Last year, four women in Winnipeg were murdered. In its final report, the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls labeled the violence as genocide. The annual ceremony is hosted by No More Silence, a group dedicated to gathering the names of those missing and murdered since 2004. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
An event to honor missing and murdered Indigenous people was held Tuesday in Minneapolis, Minnesota. It included a march and rally where advocates talked about raising awareness of MMIP and work being done to address the issue, including at the state level. State Senator Mary Kunish has been a strong advocate. She helped establish a missing and murdered Indigenous Women Task Force and a missing and murdered Indigenous Relatives Office. In remarks, Kunish vowed to continue efforts as a Native lawmaker.
We will continue working at the legislature because, yes, representation matters.
The event was live streamed by the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition, which sponsored the event along with a handful of other Native groups. This was the first in-person event in 3 years due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Members of the Apache Stronghold, a grassroots group fighting to save a sacred site, are planning a march and other events this week. They're opposed to a mining project slated for Oak Flat in Arizona. Alex Gonzalez has more.
Resolution Copper is a joint venture by Rio Tinto and BHP. Both organizations say the mine will bring thousands of jobs to the area. But Vanessa Nosey with the Apache Stronghold says Oak Flat is ancestral and sacred land. She believes the project would destroy the land and their way of life. Nosey says as a mother of four girls, she feels it's her job to protect them and their culture.
If Oak Flat is gone, I can't pass that on. And who we are spiritually, we'd be gone forever. It's the same tactic that the United States government has always used on Indian people.
The protest events begin this Thursday. The 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals hears an appeal next month that seeks to prohibit the transfer of sacred tribal lands, with Oak Flat at the center of the controversy. The land transfer to Resolution Copper was part of the 2014 National Defense Authorization Act. Apache Stronghold has argued that it violated the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. I'm Alex Gonzalez.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Iowa lawmakers are considering a bill that would open up jobs that have been off-limits to minors, some as young as 14. Supporters say it's an attempt to address a labor shortage, but opponents say it puts the state's young people at risk. Mark Moran has the details.
Iowa lawmakers are considering a bill to allow teenagers to work in jobs that have historically excluded minors for safety reasons. Supporters say the measure would help alleviate staffing shortages, but critics say it would put Iowa teens at risk. Senate File 167 would allow employers to hire kids as young as 14 if they're enrolled in work-based learning programs at school. But Iowa AFL-CIO President Charlie Wishman says the bill would allow young people to work jobs in places that put them at risk.
Meat coolers, loading and unloading equipment onto and off of vehicles, railroad cars, conveyors, hand tools, industrial laundromats.
He says dangerous jobs, such as those in meat packing or mining, that have a history of deadly accidents are still restricted, but the bill would allow the state to grant waivers for jobs in those sectors if employers can make the case that they need more workers. The Iowa Restaurant Association supports the measure, saying it would help them replace workers lost during the pandemic. A Senate committee considers the bill on Thursday morning. Wishman says there are plenty of opportunities for minors to work that don't put them at high risk of injury, such as bagging groceries. And Connie Ryan with the Interfaith Alliance of Iowa describes the bill as like taking a step back in time when minors were unprotected from dangerous working conditions. She adds it would hit especially hard in marginalized communities.
Communities who experience poverty, and they may forego their children's safety and take any number of these jobs.
Critics also point out that there's no restitution provision in the bill should a minor be seriously injured on the job. Despite opposition from labor groups across the country, efforts like this one in Iowa are part of a national trend to hire younger workers, prompted in part by low unemployment rates making employees hard to find. For Iowa News Service, I'm Mark Moran.
China says it will take measures against the U.S. for shooting down an alleged spy balloon off the American East Coast. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin spoke at a briefing but gave no details and did not identify which U.S. entities were the targets of the threat. China claims the balloon was an unmanned weather airship that was accidentally blown off course. It says the U.S. was overreacting by bringing it down with a fighter jet missile. Since the balloon was shot down, the United States has sanctioned six Chinese entities it says are linked to China's aerospace programs. The U.S. House of Representatives voted unanimously to condemn China for a violation of U.S. sovereignty. They wrote, because it tried to, quote, deceive the international community through false claims about its intelligence collection campaigns, end quote. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also canceled a visit to Beijing. Many hoped the visit would stabilize U.S.-China relations. They've been weakened over disputes about trade, human rights, Taiwan, and China's claim to the South China Sea. At first, China said it regretted that the balloon came into U.S. aerospace. Now, China has accused the U.S. of spying, too. Wang said China will, quote, resolutely safeguard national sovereignty and its legitimate rights and interests, end quote.
A new report from the nonprofit Justice in Aging says nursing homes sedate too many of the residents to make them easier to manage. They say those medications are used even for people who don't have diagnosed psychiatric disorders. Suzanne Potter reports.
Groups that advocate for older Americans are speaking out about the overuse of psychotropic medications in nursing homes. Last November, the feds reported that 80% of nursing facility residents they studied received these medications, which are supposed to treat conditions like psychosis, convulsions, depression, and anxiety. But Eric Carlson, author of a new policy brief from the nonprofit Justice in Aging, says residents are sometimes being sedated as a form of chemical restraint.
Evidence suggests that nursing facilities are using these antipsychotic medications to keep residents manageable. These are, by and large, residents who have not had a history of psychiatric conditions.
This spring, the California legislature will consider Assembly Bill 48, which would require facilities to get written consent from a patient or the patient's representative before administering psychotherapeutic drugs. The California Association of Health Facilities says it is reviewing the bill and has not taken a position. California has made significant progress on this issue. Federal data show antipsychotic use for long-stay residents dropped from more than 21% in 2011 to 10.5% in 2021. Carlson says informed consent must be a bedrock principle for all patient care.
People should say, yes, I want this medication, or no, I don't want this medication, and that decision should be made after being given information on the benefits and potential risks of the medication.
The feds use the prevalence of antipsychotic medicines to rate nursing home quality, but they don't count patients with certain diagnoses like schizophrenia. The brief points out that the number of diagnoses for that condition shot up 35% after the rating system took effect in 2015. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Wildlife crossings can play a key role in reducing roadway collisions and making sure that wildlife can migrate as the climate changes. But this infrastructure could also be affected by the changing climate. Eric Tegetoff has more on the story.
Wildlife crossings could be a path to a future where the climate has significantly changed the planet. Wildlife and climate experts are urging policymakers to plan for what they call climate-informed crossings. More than a dozen experts have released a letter highlighting the effects climate change will have on these crossings to reduce roadway collisions, and the benefit this infrastructure will have as wildlife migrates northward. Anna Wern with the Bozeman-based Center for Large Landscape Conservation says extreme weather, like the floods around Yellowstone National Park last year, damaged traditional infrastructure.
So for instance, if a stream culvert is installed beneath a road without anticipating the magnitude of future floods, it may be built too small to properly control high flows or allow fish to pass through.
Warren says crossings should be located in areas with the greatest potential to protect high-quality habitat so that wildlife can move across large landscapes. In general, wildlife is expected to move toward the poles as the climate heats up in the coming decades. Congress's Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act included $350 million for wildlife crossings. Matt Scraw is Project Director for U.S. Public Lands and Rivers Conservation at Pew Charitable Trusts. He notes flooding has increased recently and says building infrastructure to accommodate it could serve many purposes.
We can think about how we can design those structures to not only facilitate the passage of water as flooding continues to occur in the future, but we can also think about how these culverts and bridges can also accommodate terrestrial wildlife movement as well.
He says the letter from experts is a message that wildlife crossings are important tools as the nation and states think about strategies to respond to climate change. They've made some policy recommendations, including planning for long-term resilience and promoting equitable participation across governments and tribes. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts. For Big Sky Connection, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael decides to become a psychic.
It's just too quiet in the world. Nothing happening in D.C. or Salem. Gotta expect the impossible. Like all we have to worry about is balloons. Don't think how much each shot costs. Maybe Elon Musk will launch 1,000 balloons instead of satellites. Reacting to a report that 1 in 20 U.S. homicides are caused by police, national law enforcement vows to do more. Our planet's ecosystem hacks the internet and lets people vote where the next major earthquake will be. Canada announces plans to dam the Columbia just north of the border. The motion picture industry cancels the Oscars and donates all the money spent on clothes and swag to feed and shelter the houseless. The NFL says next year's Super Bowl will be played without officials. Ex-President Trump and Governor DeSantis show up in the same place and both implode. An anonymous multi-billionaire buys Fox News and gives it to Cabu. It could happen. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 15th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, curiosities, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes myself, Josh Salem, Dan Raphael, and co-anchor Reed Johnson. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Eric Tegetoff, Catherine Carley, Suzanne Potter, Roz Brown, Antonia Gonzalez, and Mark Moran. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Reed Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.